Blackstone Audio presents The Many-Colored Land, Volume 1 of the Saga of Pliocene Exile, by Julian May. For Thaddeus Maxim, the noblest of them all. My heart is sore pained within me, and the terrors of death are fallen upon me. Fear and trembling have seized me, and darkness has overwhelmed me. And I said, "Oh, that I had wings like a dove, for then I would fly away and be at rest. Lo, would I flee far away and live in the wilderness. I would wait for him who will save me from my cowardice and from the storm." Psalm 55. Prologue 1. To confirm that it was indeed near death, the great vessel broke through into normal space with lingering slowness. The pain of the usually swift translation was prolonged as well, until the thousand, for all their strength, cursed and wept within their minds, and became convinced that they would be trapped. It would be the gray limbo endlessly. That and pain. But the ship was doing its best. Sharing the agony of the passengers, it pushed and pried against the tough fabric of the superficies until there were flickers of black against the gray. The ship and the people felt their anguish dim into a mere harmony of nearly musical vibrations that echoed, damped, and finally snapped off. They hung in normal space, stars all around them. The ship had emerged in the shadow cone of a planet. For long moments, as the stunned travelers watched without knowing what they saw, the halo of pink atmosphere and the pearly wings of the eclipsed sun's corona gave an aureole to the black world. Then the ship's ominous momentum carried them on. The chromosphere and the orange flames of the sun's limb burst forth, followed by its dazzling yellow substance. The ship curved in. The sunlit surface of the planet seemed to roll open beneath them at their approach. It was a blue world with white clouds and snowy mountains and land masses of ochre and red and gray-green. Beyond doubt, a world of compatible life. The ship had succeeded. Thagdal turned to the small women at the directive console. Breed of the Two Faces shook her head. Dreary violet patterns on the motive display made plain that it had been the final effort of the ship that brought them to this haven. They were fully in the grip of the system's gravity and no longer capable of inertialess locomotion. Thagdal's mind and voice spoke. "Listen to me, remnant of battle companies. Our faithful craft has all but perished. It subsists only on mechanicals now, and they will not serve much longer. We are on an impact trajectory, and we must disembark before the Hulk enters the lower atmosphere." Emanations of sorrow, rage, and fear filled the dying ship. Questions and reproaches threatened to stifle the mind of Thagdal until he touched the golden torque around his neck and forced them all to be silent. "In the name of the goddess, hold! Our venture was a great gamble. With all minds turned against us, Breed is concerned that this place may not be the perfect refuge we had hoped for. Nevertheless, it is fully compatible in a remote galaxy where none will dare to look for us. We are safe, and have not had to use spear or sword. Breed and our ship have done well to bring us here. Praise to their strength!" The antiphon was raised dutifully, but sticking up out of the symmetry of it was a prickly thought. "Hymns be damned. Can we survive here?" Thagdal lashed back. "We will survive, if compassionate Tana wills, and even find the joy that has eluded us so long. But no thanks to you, Palal. Shadow Sib, ancient enemy, truce breaker. When we are delivered from this immediate peril, you will answer to me." A certain amount of vulgar enmity swirled up to merge with Palal's. but it was fogged by the dull-witted tone of mind that comes from the relief of terrible pain. Nobody else really wanted to fight now. Only the irrepressible Palol was as game as ever. Breedship Spouse flowed soothingly over the impending shambles. "This many-colored land will be a good place for us, my king. And you need have no fear, Palol One-Eye. I have already sounded the planet, lightly of course, and found no mental challenge. The dominant life form dwells in speechless innocence and can be no threat to us for more than 6 million planetary orbits. Yet its germplasm is indeed compatible for the nurturing and the service. With patience and skilled labor, we will surely survive. Now let us go forth from here, holding to our truce a while longer. Let no one speak of vengeance, nor of mistrust of my beloved spouse."
"Well said, prescient lady," came the thoughts and spoken words of the others. Any dissenters were now keeping well submerged.
Thagdal said,
"The small flyers are waiting for us. As we depart, let all minds be raised in salute."
He went stomping from the control deck, golden hair and beard still crackling with squelched fury, white robes brushing over the now dulled metalloid of the decking. Idone, Dianket, and Mavar Kingmaker followed after, minds linked in the song, fingers giving a farewell caress to the fast cooling walls that had once thrummed with benevolent power. Little by little, the others in various parts of the ship took up the anthem, until nearly all of them were in communion. Flyers spurted away from the moribund vessel. More than 40 bird-like machines pierced the atmosphere like glowing darts before decelerating abruptly and spreading their wings. One took the lead and the others formed a stately procession in its wake. They flew toward the world's largest landmass to await the calculated impact, came up from the south and crossed over the most distinctive feature of the planet, a vast, nearly dry sea basin, glittering with salt pans, which cut an irregular gash across the western reaches of the major continent. A snowy range made a barrier north of this empty sea. The flyers went beyond the mountains and hovered over the valley of a large eastward-flowing river, waiting. The ship entered on a westerly course, leaving a fiery trail as it ablated in the atmosphere. It swept the ground with a horrendous pressure wave that incinerated vegetation and altered the very minerals of the landscape below. Molten globules of green and brown glass showered the eastern highlands as the ship's integument exploded away, the river waters vaporized from their bed. Then came the impact. Light burst and heat burst and sound burst, as more than 2,000 million tons of matter, with the velocity of 22 kilometers per second, inflicted its wound upon the world. The country rock metamorphosed. The substance of the ship was all but consumed in the holocaust. Nearly 100 cubic kilometers of planetary crust exploded upward and outward, the finer products rising in a black column to the stratosphere, where the high, thin winds spread them in a pall of mourning over much of the world. The resultant crater was nearly 30 kilometers in diameter, but not very deep, battered by tornadic storms engendered in the affronted atmosphere above the glowing ulcer in the land. The small flyers circled solemnly above it for many days, oblivious of the muddy hurricane as they waited for the earth fires to cool. When the rain had done its work, the flyers departed for a long time. They returned to the grave when their tasks were finally done, and rested for 1,000 years. 2. The little Ramapithecus was stubborn. She was certain that the baby must have gone into the tangle of Maquis. His scent was there, distinct in spite of the heavy springtime perfume of heather, thyme, and gorse. Uttering crooning calls, the Ramapithecus forced her way into the ancient, burned-over area, moving uphill. A lapwing, vivid yellow and black, gave a peewit cry and limped away, trailing one wing. The Ramapithecus knew that this charade was intended to distract her from a nearby nest, but thoughts of bird prey were far from her simple mind. All she wanted was her missing child. She toiled up the overgrown slope using a piece of tree branch to beat down the brush that impeded her. She was able to utilize this tool and a few others. Her brow was low, but her face was quite vertical, with a small humanoid jaw. Her body, a little over a meter in height, was only slightly stooped and clothed, except for the face and palms, in short brown fur. She continued her crooning. It was a message not framed in words which any young one of the species would recognize. Here is mother. Come to her and be safe and comforted. The Mekhi thinned out as she reached the crest of the height. Out in the open at last, she looked around and gave a low moan of fear. She stood on the edge of a monstrous basin containing a lake of deepest blue color. The rim curved away to the horizon on either hand, completely barren of vegetation along the narrow lip and down the steep slope to the water. About 20 meters away from her stood a terrible bird. It was something like a fat heron, but as tall as a pine tree and just as long, with wings, head, and tail drooping sadly to the ground. From its belly trailed a knobby appendage with climbing holds. The bird was hard, not made of flesh. It was layered in dust, crusted and scabbed with yellow and gray and orange lichen over what had once been a smooth black skin. Far along the rim of the astrobleam in both directions, she could see other such birds standing widely spaced, all looking into the dark mirrored depths. The Ramapithecus prepared to flee. Then she heard a familiar sound. She gave a sharp hoot. Immediately, a tiny upside-down head popped out of an orifice in the belly of the nearby bird. The child chittered happily. His sounds had the meaning, "Welcome, mother. This is fun. Look what is here." Exhausted, overcome by relief, her hands bloody from breaking through the thorns, the mother howled in fury at her offspring. Hastily, he came down the exit ladder of the flyer and scuttled up to her. She scooped him up and crushed him to her breast. Then she put him down and cuffed the sides of his head, left, right, pouring out a torrent of indignant chatter. Trying to placate her, he held out the thing he had found. It resembled a large ring, but was really 2 conjoined semicirclets of twisted gold, thick as a finger and rounded, incised with tortuous little markings like the borings of gribbles in sea-logged wood. The young Ramapithecus grinned and snapped open 2 knobby ends of the ring. The other ends were held by a kind of pivoting hinge that allowed the halves to rotate and open wide. The child placed the ring around his neck, twisted it, and snapped the catch shut. The golden torque gleamed against his tawny fur, much too large for him, but alive with power nevertheless. Smiling still, he showed his mother what he was now able to do. She shrieked. The child leaped in dismay. He tripped over a rock and fell backward. Before he could recover, his mother was upon him, yanking the ring over his head so that the metal bruised his ears, and it hurt. The loss of it hurt worse than any pain he had ever known. He must get it back. The mother screamed even louder as he tried to grab at the torque. Her voice echoed across the crater lake. She flung the golden thing as far away as she could into a dense thicket of spiny gorse. The child wailed his broken-hearted protest, but she seized his arm and hauled him toward the path she had made through the Mekhi. Well concealed, and only slightly dented, the torque gleamed in the dappled shadows. 3. In the early years after humanity, with a little help from its friends, had set out to overrun the compatible stars, a professor of dynamic field physics named Théo Goudrion
discovered the way into exile. His researches, like those of so many other unorthodox but promising thinkers of the time, were sustained by a no-strings grant from the human polity of the galactic milieu. Gudrun lived on the old world because science had so many other things to assimilate in those exciting times, and because Gudrun's discovery seemed to have no practical application whatsoever in 2034. The publication of his culminating paper caused only a brief flutter in the dovecot of physical cosmology. But in spite of the prevailing air of indifference, a small number of workers from all six of the coagenate galactic races continued to be curious enough about Gudrun's findings to seek him out in his modest home-cum-workshop outside of Lyon. Even as his health failed, the professor received these visiting colleagues with courtesy and assured them that he would be honored to repeat his experiment for them if they would pardon the crudities of his apparatus, which he had removed to the cellar of his cottage after the Institute disclaimed further interest in it. It took Madame Gudrun some time to become resigned to the exotic pilgrims from other stars. One had, after all, to preserve the social convenances by entertaining the guests, but there were difficulties. She overcame her aversion to the tall, androgynous Guy after much mental exercise, and one could always pretend that the Poltroians were civilized gnomes. But she could never get used to the awesome Krandaku, or the half-visible Lilmic. And one could only deplore the way that some of the less fastidious Symbiari dripped green on the carpet. What was to be the last group of guests called just 3 days before Professor Gudrion's terminal illness commenced. Madame opened the door to greet two outworld male humans, one alarmingly massive and the other quite ordinary, an urbane little Poltroian, wearing the gorgeous robes of a full elucidator, a 2.5-meter Guy, mercifully with clothes on, and Saint Vierge, no less than 3 Symbiari. She welcomed them and put out extra ashtrays and wastebaskets. Professor Gudrun conducted the extraterrestrial visitors to the cellar of the large country cottage just as soon as the politenesses had been exchanged. "We will proceed at once to the demonstration, good friends. You will forgive me, but today I am a trifle fatigued." "Most regrettable," said the solicitous Poltroian. "Perhaps, my dear professor, you would benefit from a rejuvenative course?" "No, no," Gudrun said with a smile. "One lifetime is quite enough for me. I feel I am most fortunate to have lived in the era of the Great Intervention. But I must confess that events now seem to be moving faster than my composure can tolerate. I look forward to the ultimate peace." They passed through a metal-sheathed door into what was apparently a converted wine cellar. An area of stone paving some 3 meters square had been removed, leaving bare earth. Gudrun's apparatus stood in the middle of it. The old man rummaged for a moment in an antique oak cabinet near the door and came up with a small pile of reading plaques, which he distributed to the scientists. "Appraisy of my theoretical considerations and diagrams of the device are contained in these booklets, which my wife has been kind enough to prepare for visitors. You must excuse the simplicity of the format. We have long since exhausted our major funding." The others murmured sympathetically. "Please stand here for the demonstration. You will observe that the device has certain affinities to the subspace translator, and thus requires very little power input. My own modifications have been designed with a view toward phasing in residual magnetics contained in the local rock strata, together with the deeper contemporary fields being generated beneath the continental platform. These, interacting with the matrices of the translator fields, generate the singularity." Gudrun reached into the pocket of his work smock and took out a large carrot. With a Gallic shrug, he remarked, "Expedient, if somewhat ridiculous." He placed the carrot on an ordinary wooden stool and carried it to the apparatus. Kudrion's device rather resembled an old-fashioned latticework pergola or gazebo draped in vines. However, the frame was made of transparent, vitreous material, except for peculiar, nodular components of dead black, and the vines were actually cables of colorful alloys that seemed to grow up from the cellar floor, creep in and out of the lattice in a disconcerting fashion, and abruptly disappear at a point just short of the ceiling. When the stool and its carrot were in position, Kudrion rejoined his guests and activated the device. There was no sound. The gazebo shimmered momentarily. Then it seemed as if mirror panels sprang into existence, hiding the interior of the apparatus completely from view.
"You will understand that a certain waiting period is now in order," the old man said. "The carrot is almost always effective, but from time to time there are disappointments."
The seven visitors waited. The wide-shouldered human clutched his book plaque in both hands but never let his eyes leave the gazebo. The other colonial, a placid type from some institute on Londinium, made a tactful examination of the control panel. The Gi and the Poltroian read their booklets with equanimity. One of the younger Symbiari inadvertently let an emerald drop fall and made haste to scuff it into the cellar floor. Numerals on the wall chronometer flickered past. 5 minutes. 10.
"We will see whether our game is afoot," the professor said, with a wink at the man from Londinium.
The mirrored energy field snapped off. For the merest nanosecond, the startled scientists were aware of a pony-shaped creature standing inside the gazebo. It turned instantly to an articulated skeleton. As the bones fell, they disintegrated into grayish powder.
"Shit!" exclaimed the seven eminent scientists. "Be calm, colleagues," said Kudrion. "Such a denouement is unfortunately inevitable, but we shall project a slow-motion hollow so that our catch may be identified."
He switched on a concealed tri-D projector and froze the action to reveal a small horse-like animal with amiable black eyes, three-toed feet, and a russet coat marked with faint white stripes. Carrot greens stuck out of its mouth. The wooden stool was beside it.
"Hipparion gracile, a cosmopolitan species abundant during Earth's Pliocene epoch."
Kudrion let the projector run. The stool quietly dissolved. The hide and flesh of the little horse shriveled with dreadful slowness, peeling away from the skeleton and exploding into a cloud of dust, while the internal organs simultaneously swelled, shrank, and puffed into nothingness. The bones continued to stand upright, then tumbled in graceful, slow arcs. Their first contact with the cellar floor reduced them to their component minerals. The sensitive Gi let out a sigh and closed its great yellow eyes. The Londoner had turned pale, while the other human, from the rugged and morose world of Skipni, chewed on his large brown mustache. The incontinent young Simb made haste to utilize a wastebasket.
"I have tried both plant and animal bait in my little trap," Kudrion said. "Carrot or rabbit or mouse may make the trip to the Pliocene unharmed, but on the return journey, any living thing that is within the tar field inevitably assumes the burden of more than 6 million years of earthly existence."
"And inorganic matter?" inquired the Skipetar.
"Of a certain density, of a certain crystalline structure, many specimens make the round trip in fairly good condition. I have even been successful in circumtranslating two forms of organic matter. Amber and coal travel unscathed."
"But this is most intriguing," said the prime contemplator of the 26th College of Simb.
"The theory of temporal plication has been in our repository for some 70,000 of your years, my worthy Kudrion.
but its demonstration eluded the best minds of the galactic milieu. Until now. The fact that you, a human scientist, have been even partially successful, where so many others have failed, is surely one more confirmation of the unique abilities of the children of Earth. The sour grape flavor of his speech was not lost on the Poltroian. His ruby eyes twinkled as he said, "The amalgam of Poltroi, unlike certain other coaginate races, never doubted that the intervention was fully justified." "For you and your milieu, perhaps," said Gudrian in a low voice. His dark eyes, pain-tinged behind rimless eyeglasses, showed a momentary bitterness. "But what of us? We had to give up so much. Our diverse languages, many of our social philosophies and religious dogmata, our so-called non-productive lifestyles, our very human sovereignty, laughable though its loss must seem to the ancient intellects of the galactic milieu." The man from Squeepney exclaimed, "How can you doubt the wisdom of it, Professor? We humans gave up a few cultural fripperies, and gained energy sufficiency, and unlimited Lebensraum, and membership in a galactic civilization. Now that we don't have to waste time and lives in mere survival, there'll be no holding humanity back. Our race is just beginning to fulfill its genetic potential, which may be greater than that of any other people." The Londoner winced. The prime contemplator said suavely, "Ah, the proverbial human breeding capacity. How it does keep the gene pool roiled. One is reminded of the well-known reproductive superiority of the adolescent organism as compared to that of the mature individual, whose plasm, while less prodigally broadcast, may nonetheless burgeon more prudently in the pursuit of genetic optima."
"Did you say mature?" sneered the Skipetar. "Or atrophied?"
"Colleagues, colleagues," exclaimed the diplomatic little Poltroian. "We will weary Professor Gudrian." "Oh, it's all right," the old man said, but he looked gray and ill. The Gee hastened to change the subject. "Surely this effect you have demonstrated would be a splendid tool for paleobiology."
"I fear," Gudrian replied, "that there is limited galactic interest in the extinct life forms of Earth's Rhone-Sohn trough."
"Then you haven't been able to, tune the device for retrieval in other areas?" asked the Londoner.
"Alas, no, my dear Sanders, nor have other workers been able to reproduce my experiment in other localities on Earth or on other worlds."
Gudrian tapped one of the plaque books.
"As I have pointed out, there is a problem in computing the subtleties of the geomagnetic input. This region of southern Europe has one of the more complex geomorphologies of the planet. Here in the Monte Leone and the Fori, we have a foreland of the utmost antiquity, cheek by jowl with recent volcanic intrusions. In nearby regions of the Massif Central, we see even more clearly the workings of intracrustal metamorphism, the anatexis engendered above one or more ascending asthenospheric diapers. To the east lie the Alps with their stupendously folded naps. South of here is the Mediterranean basin, with active subduction zones, which was, incidentally, in an extremely peculiar condition during the Lower Pliocene epoch."
"So you're in a dead end, eh?" remarked the Skipetar. "Too bad Earth's Pliocene period wasn't all that interesting. Just a few million years marking time between the Miocene and the Ice Age. The shank of the Cenozoic, so to speak." Gudrian produced a small whisk broom and dustpan and began to tidy up the gazebo.
"It was a golden time. Just before the dawn of rational humankind. A time of benevolent climate and flourishing plant and animal life. A vintage time, unspoiled and tranquil. An autumn before the terrible winter
of the Pleistocene glaciation.
Rousseau would have loved the Pliocene epoch. Uninteresting. There are even today soul-weary people in this galactic milieu who would not share your evaluation.
The scientists exchanged glances.
If only it weren't a one-way trip, said the man from Londinium.
Gudrion was calm.
All of my efforts to change the facies of the singularity have been in vain. It is fixed in Pliocene time, in the uplands of this venerable river valley. And so we come to the heart of the matter at last. The great achievement of time travel stands revealed as a mere scientific curiosity.
Once more, the Gallic shrug.
Future workers will profit from your pioneering effort, declared the Poltroian. The others hurried to add appropriate felicitations.
Enough, dear colleagues, Gudrion laughed. You have been most kind to visit an old man. And now we must go up to Madame, who awaits with refreshment. I bequeath to sharper minds the practical application of my peculiar little experiment.
He winked at the outworld humans and tipped the contents of the dustpan into the wastebasket. The ashes of the Hipparion floated in little blobby islands on the green alien slime. Part 1. The Leave-Taking. 1. Burnished trumpets sounded a flourish. The ducal party rode gaily out of the Chateau de Riom, horses prancing and curvetting as they had been trained, giving a show of spirit without imperiling the ladies in their chancy side saddles. Sunshine sparkled on the jeweled comparisons of the mounts, but it was the gorgeous riders who earned the crowd's applause. Greenish-blue reflections from the festive scene on the monitor blackened Mercedes Lombal's auburn hair and threw livid lights across her thin face.
The tourists draw lots to be in the procession of nobles, she explained to Grenfell. It's more fun to be common, but try to tell them that. Of course, the principals are all pros.
Jean Duc de Berry raised his arm to the cheering throng. He wore a long houppelande in his own heraldic blue, powdered with fleur-de-lis. The dagged sleeves were turned back to show a rich lining of yellow brocade. The Duke's hosen were pure white, embroidered with golden spangles, and he wore golden spurs. At his side rode the prince, Charles de Lyon. His robes parti-colored in the royal scarlet, black and white, his heavy golden baldric fringed with tinkling bells. Other nobles in the train, gaudy as a flock of spring warblers, followed after with the ladies.
"Isn't there a hazard?" Grenfell asked. Horses with untrained riders? I should think you'd stick with robot mounts.
Lombal said softly.
It has to be real. This is France, you know. The horses are specifically bred for intelligence and stability.
In honor of the Meng, the betrothed Princess Bonne and her retinue were dressed in malachite green silk. The noble maidens wore the quaint headdresses of the early 15th century, fretted gilt wire confections threaded with jewels, rising up on their braided coiffures like kitten ears. The crepine of the princess was even more outlandish, extending out from her temples in long golden horns, with a white lawn veil draped over the wires.
"Cue the flower girls," said Gaston from the other side of the control room.
Mercy Lombal sat still, gazing at the brilliant picture with rapt intensity. The antennae of her comset made the strange headpiece of the medieval princess out on the chateau grounds look almost ordinary in comparison.
"Merce," the director repeated with gentle insistence. "The flower girls?"
Slowly she reached out a hand, keying the marshalling channel. Trumpets sounded again, and the peasant crowd of tourists oohed. Dozens of dimpled little maids in short gowns of pink and white came running out of the orchard, carrying baskets of apple blossoms. They romped along the road in front of the ducal procession, strewing flowers, while flageolets and trombones struck up a lively air. Jugglers, acrobats, and a dancing bear joined the mob. The princess blew kisses to the crowd, and the duke distributed an occasional piece of largesse.
"Cue the courtiers," said Gaston.
The woman at the control console sat motionless. Brian Grenfell could see drops of moisture on her brow, dampening the straying tendrils of auburn hair. Her mouth was tight.
"Mercy, what is it?" Grenfell whispered. "What's wrong?"
"Nothing," she said.
Her voice was husky and strained.
"Courtiers away, Gaston."
Three young men, also dressed in green, came galloping from the woods toward the procession of nobility, bearing armfuls of leafy sprigs. With much giggling, the ladies twined these into head wreaths and crowned the chevaliers of their choice. The men reciprocated with dainty chaplets for the damsels, and they all resumed their ride toward the meadow where the maypole waited. Meanwhile, directed by Mercy's commands, barefoot girls and grinning youths distributed flowers and greenery to the slightly self-conscious crowd, crying,
"Vert, vert pour la mer!"
Right on cue, the duke and his party began to sing along with the flutes.
"C'est la mer, c'est la mer. C'est le joli mois de mai."
"They're off pitch again," Gaston said in an exasperated voice. "Cue in the filler voices, Merce, and let's have the lark loops and a few yellow butterflies."
He keyed for voice on the marshalling channel and exclaimed,
"Aminu, get that clod out from in front of the duke's horse and watch the kid in red. Looks like he's twitching bells off the prince's baldric."
Mercedes Lamballe brought up the auxiliary voices as ordered. The entire crowd joined in the song, having slept on it on the way from Charlemagne's coronation. Mercy made birdsong fill the blossom-laden orchard and sent out signals that released the butterflies from their secret cages. Unbidden, she conjured up a scented breeze to cool the tourists from Aquitaine and Nuestra and Blois and Foix and all the other French planets in the galactic milieu who had come, together with Francophiles and medievalists from scores of other worlds, to savor the glories of ancient Auvergne.
"They'll be getting warm now, Bri," she remarked to Grenfell. "The breeze will make them happier."
Brian relaxed at the more normal tone in her voice. "I guess there are limits to the inconveniences they'll endure in the name of immersive cultural pageantry."
"We reproduce the past," Lamballe said, "as we would have liked it to be. The realities of medieval France are another trip altogether." "We have stragglers, Merce."
Gaston's hands flashed over the control panel in the preliminary choreography of the Maypole suite.
"I see two or three exotics in the bunch, probably those comparative ethnologists from the Krondak world we were alerted about. Better bring over a troubadour to keep them happy until they catch up with the main group. These visiting firemen are apt to write snotty evaluations if you let them get bored."
"Some of us keep our objectivity," Grenfell said mildly. The director snorted.
"Well, you're not out there tramping through horseshit in fancy dress in the hot sun on a world with low subjective oxygen and double subjective gravity. Merce? Damn it, kiddo, are you fuguing off again?"
Brian rose from his seat and came to her, grave concern on his face.
"Gaston, can't you see she's ill?"
"I'm not."
Mercy was sharp.
"It's going to pass off in a minute or two. Troubadour away, Gaston."
The monitor zoomed in on a singer who bowed to the little knot of laggards, struck a chord on his lute, and began expertly herding the people toward the maypole area, while soothing them with song. The piercing sweetness of his tenor filled the control room. He sang first in French, then in the standard English of the human polity of the galactic milieu, for those who weren't up to the archaic linguistics.
"Le temps au lycée sans monture. Des vents, des fois dieu et des pluies, et ses vestus de broderie, de soleil lusin, clair et bon."
Now time has put off its dark cloak of gales and of frosts and of rain, and garbs itself in woven light, bright sunshine of spring once again. A genuine lark added its own coda to the minstrel's song. Mercy lowered her head, and tears fell onto the console before her. That damn song, and springtime in the Auvergne, and the friggerty larks, and retro-evolved butterflies, and manicured meadows and orchards,
crammed with gratified folk from faraway planets, where the living was tough, but the challenge was being met by all but the inevitable misfits, who slubbed the beautiful growing tapestry of the galactic milieu. Misfits like Mercy Lamval.
"Boku regrets, guys,"
she said with a rueful smile, mopping her face with a tissue.
"Wrong phase of the moon, I guess. Or the old Celtic rising. Bri, you just picked the wrong day to visit this crazy place. Sorry."
"All you Celts are bonkers,"
Gaston excused her with breezy kindness.
"There's a Breton engineer over in the Sun King pageant who told me he can only shoot his wad when he's doing it on a megalith. Come on, babe, let's keep the show rolling."
On the screens, the maypole dancers twined their ribbons and pivoted in intricate patterns. The Duc de Berry and the other actors of his entourage permitted thrilled tourists to admire the indubitably real gems that adorned their costumes. Flutes piped, corner muses wailed, hawkers peddled comfits and wine, shepherds let people pet their lambs, and the sun smiled down. All was well in La Douce France, A.D., 1410, and so it would be for another 6 hours, through the tournament and culminating feast. And then the weary tourists, 700 years removed from the medieval world of the Duc de Berry, would be whisked off in comfortable subway tubes to their next cultural immersion at Versailles. And Brian Grenfell and Mercy Lamball would go down to the orchard as evening fell, to talk of sailing to Ajaccio together, and to see how many of the butterflies had survived. 2. The alert Claxton hooted through the ready room of Lisboa Power Grid's central staging.
"Well, hell, I was folding anyhow," Big Georgina remarked.
She hoisted the portable air conditioning unit of her armor and clomped off to the waiting drill rigs, helmet under her arm. Stein Olsen slammed his cards down on the table. His beaker of booze went over and sluiced the meager pile of chips in front of him.
"And me with a king-high tiz in the first decent pot all day. Damn lucky granny banging trisomics."
He lurched to his feet, upsetting the reinforced chair, and stood swaying 2 meters and 15 cents worth of ugly, handsome berserker. The reddened sclera of his eyeballs contrasted oddly with the bright blue irises. Olsen glared at the other players and bunched up his mailed, servo-powered fists. Hubert gave a deep guffaw. He could laugh, having come out on top.
"Tough kitty! Simmer down, Stein. Sopping up all that mouthwash didn't help your game much."
The fourth card player chimed in.
"I told you to take it easy on the gargle, Steiny, and now look it, we gotta go down and you're half plotzed again."
Olsen gave the man a look of murderous contempt. He shed the AC walk-around, climbed into his own drill rig, and began plugging himself in.
"You keep your trap shut, Django. Even blind drunk I can zap a truer bore than any scat-eating old Portuguese sardine stroker." "Oh, for God's sake," said Hubert, "will you two quit?" "You try teaming up with an ory-eyed squarehead," Django said.
He blew his nose, in the Iberian fashion, over the neck rim of his armor, then locked on his helmet. Olsen sneered.
"And you call me slob?"
The electronic voice of Georgina, the team leader, gave them the bad news as they went through the systems check.
"We've lost the Cabo da Roca Azores mainline bore 793 kloms out and the service tunnel too. Class 3 slippage and overthrust, but at least the fistula sealed. Looks like a long trick, children."
Stein Olsen powered up. His 180-ton rig rose 30 cents off the deck, slid out of its bay, and sashayed down the ramp, wagging its empennage like a slightly tipsy iron dinosaur.
"Madre de Deus," growled Django's voice.
His machine came after Stein's, obeying the taxi regulation scrupulously.
"He's a menace, Georgina. I'll be damned if I drill tandem with him, I'm telling you. I'll file a beef with the Union. How'd you like to have a drunken numb with the only thing between your ass and a bleb of red-hot basalt?"
Olsen's bellowed laughter clanged in all their ears.
"Go ahead and file with the Union, pussy willow. Then get yourself a job to fit your nerve, like drilling holes in Swiss cheeses with your..."
"Will you cut that crap?" Georgina said wearily.
Hubie, you partner with Django this shift, and I'll go tandem with Stein.
Now, wait a minute, Georgina, Olsen began.
It's settled, Stein, she cycled the airlock. You and Big Mama against the world, Blue Eyes, and save your soul for Jesus if you don't sober up before we hit that break. Let's haul, children.
A massive gate, 11 meters high and nearly as thick, swung open to give them entry to the service tunnel that dived under the sea. Georgina had fed the coordinates of the break into the auto helms of their drill rigs, so all they had to do for a while was relax, wiggle around in their armor, and maybe snuff up a euphoric or two while hurtling along at 500 kilometers per hour toward a mess under the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean. Stein Olsen raised the partial pressure of his oxygen and gave himself a jolt of Aldatox and Stimvim. Then he ordered the armor's meal unit to deliver a liter of raw egg and smoked herring puree, together with his favorite hair of the dog, Aquavit. There was a low muttering in his helmet receiver.
Damn atavistic cacafogo! Ought to mount a set of ox horns on his helmet and wrap his iron ass in a bearskin jockstrap.
Stein smiled in spite of himself. In his favorite fantasies, he did imagine himself a Viking, or, since he had both Norse and Swedish genes, perhaps a Varangian marauder slashing his way southward into ancient Russia. How wonderful it would be to answer insults with an axe or a sword, unfettered by the stupid constraints of civilization. To let the red anger flow as it was meant to, powering his great muscles for battle. To take strong blonde women, who would first fight him off, then yield with sweet openness. He was born for a life like that. But unfortunately for Stein Olsen, human cultural savagery was extinct in the Galactic Age, mourned only by a few ethnologists, and the subtleties of the new mental barbarians were beyond Stein's power to grasp. This exciting and dangerous job of his had been vouchsafed him by a compassionate computer, but his soul hunger remained unsatisfied. He had never considered emigrating to the stars. On no human colony anywhere in the galactic milieu was there a primal Eden. The germplasm of humanity was too valuable to fritter in Neolithic backwaters. Each of the 783 new human worlds was completely civilized, bound by the ethics of the Consilium and obligated to contribute toward the slowly coalescing whole. People who hankered after their simpler roots had to be content with visiting the old world's painstaking restorations of ancient cultural settings, or with the exquisitely orchestrated immersive pageants, almost, but not quite, authentic to the last detail, which let a person actively savor selected portions of his heritage. Stein, who was born in the old world, had gone to the Fjordland Saga when he was barely out of adolescence, traveling from Chicago Metro to Scandinavia with other vacationing students. He was ejected from the Longboat Invaders pageant and heavily fined after leaping into the midst of a mock melee, chopping a hairy Norseman's arm off, and rescuing a kidnapped British maiden from rape. The wounded actor was philosophical about his 3 months in the regeneration tank. "Just the hazards of the trade, kid," he had told his remorseful attacker. Some years later, after Stein had matured and found a certain release in his work, he had gone to the Saga pageants again. This time, they seemed pathetic. Stein saw the happy outworld visitors from Tondelag and Tull and Finnmark and all the other Scandinavian planets as a pack of silly costumed fools, waders in the shallows, nibblers, masturbators, pathetic chasers after lost identity.
"What will you do when you find out who you are? Great-grandchildren of test tubes," he had screamed, fighting drunk at the Valhalla feast. "Go back where you came from, to the new worlds the monsters gave you."
Then he had climbed up onto the Azer's table and peed in the mead bowl. They ejected and fined him again, and this time his credit card was pipped so that he was automatically turned away by every pageant box office.
The speeding drill rigs raced beneath the continental slope, their headlights catching glints of pink, green, and white from the granite walls of the tunnel. Then the machines penetrated the dark basalt of the deep ocean crust below the Tagus abyssal plain, just 3 kilometers above their service tunnel were the waters of the sea. 10 kilometers below lay the molten mantle. As they drove 2 abreast through the lithosphere, the members of the team had the illusion of going down a gigantic ramp with sharp drops at regular intervals. The rigs would fly straight and level, then nose down sharply on a new straight path, only to repeat the maneuver a few moments later. The service tunnel was following the curvature of the Earth in a series of straight-line increments. It had to, because of the power transmittal bore it served, a parallel tunnel with a diameter just great enough to admit a single drill rig when there was a need for major repairs. In most parts of the complex undersea power system, service tunnels and bores were connected by adits every 10 kilometers, allowing the maintenance crews easy access. But if they had to, the drill rigs could zap right through the rough rock walls of the service tunnel and mole their way to the bore from any angle. Until the time when the alarm had run in Lisboa, the mainline bore between continental Europe and the extensive Azores mariculture farms had been lit with the glare of a photon beam. This ultimate answer to Earth's ancient energy hunger originated at this time of day in the sunshine of the Serra da Estrela Tier 39 Collection Center northwest of Lisboa Metro, with its sister centers at Jiuquen, Akebono Platform, and Cedar Bluffs, Kansas. It gathered and distributed solar energy to be used by consumers adjacent to the 39 North Parallel all around the globe. A complex of spidery stratotowers, secure against the forces of gravity and high above the weather, gathered light rays from the cloudless skies, arranged them into a coherent beam, and sent this to be distributed safely underground via a web of mainline and local feeder bores. A photon from the Portuguese, or Chinese, or Pacific, or Kansas, daylight, would be directed on its way by means of plasma mirrors, operating within the bores, and would reach the fog-bound folk in the farms of the North Atlantic before an eye could blink. The ocean farmers utilized the power for everything from submarine harvesters to electric blankets. Few of the consumers would bother to think where the energy came from. Like all of Earth's subterranean power bores, Cabo da Roca Azores was regularly patrolled by small robot crawlers and muckers. These could make minor repairs when the planetary crust shifted in a common Class 1 incident, not even interrupting the photon beam. Class 2 damage was severe enough to cause an automatic shutdown. Perhaps a tremor would shift a segment of the bore slightly out of alignment, or damage one of the vital mirror stations. Crews from the surface would race to the scene of the disruption via the service tunnels, and the repairs were usually made very quickly. But on this day, the tectonic adjustment had been rated at Class 3. The Despacho fracture zone had shrugged, and a web of minor faults in the sub-oceanic basalt had waggled in sympathy. Hot rocks surrounding a 3-kilometer section of the paired tunnels suddenly moved north-south, east-west, up-down, crumpling not only the power bore, but the much larger surface tunnel as well. As the mirror station vaporized in a very small thermonuclear flash, the searing photons of the beam burned undeflected for a microsecond before safety cut off. The beam punched through the shattered bore wall and continued to burn a straight arrow path westward through the crust until it broke through the sea floor. There was a steam explosion in the liquefied rock just as the beam died, which effectively sealed the fistula. But a large region that had formerly been fairly stable solid rock was now reduced to a shambles of rubble, cooked oceanic ooze, and slowly cooling pockets of molten lava. A bypass restored power to the Azores within 1 second after the break. Until the repairs were made, the islands would take most of their energy from the Tier 38 Collection Center, northwest of Lorca in Spain, via Gibraltar Madeira. Drill crews from both ends of the damaged bore segment would get to clean up the mess, rebuild the mirror,
and spin reinforcements leaves for the tunnels passing through the new zone of instability. Then there would be light once again.
Lizbong leader, this is Ponta del 3 Alpha, coming up on Clom 7-9-7, come on.
Lizbong 16 Echo, gotcha, Ponta del, said Georgina. We're at 7-8 zip and rolling, 7-8-5, 7-9 zip, and at the fall, 7-9-2. You guys gonna take the fistula?
Affirm, Lizbong, with one unit on the bore for link-up.
Long time no see, Georgina, but we gotta stop meeting like this. Put your best zapper on the mainline rebore, sweetie. She's gonna be a sneako rascal, come on.
Have no fear, Ponta del. See you in the short, Larry Lovey. 16 Echo gone.
Stein Olsen gritted his teeth and gripped the twin joysticks of his rig. He knew he was the best shot Lisboa had. Nobody could zap a truer bore than he could. Lava blisters, magnetic anims, nothing ever threw him off the true. He got ready to blast.
Hubert, get on that mainline rebore, Georgina said.
Humiliation and rage twisted Stein's guts. A nauseous blend of bile and herring rose in his throat. He swallowed. He breathed. He waited.
Django, you follow Hubie with the sleeves spinning until you hit the mirror. Then get on that. Steiny, let's you and me open up this service tunnel.
Right you are, Georgina, Stein said quietly. He thumbed the stud on his right stick. A greenish-white ray blazed out of the rig's nose. Slowly, the two big machines began to cut through the fall of steaming black rock, while little robot muckers scuttled about, hauling the debris away. 3. The entire Voorhees clan had taken to deep space almost immediately after the Great Intervention. It was to be expected of the descendants of New Amsterdam skippers and four generations of U.S. Navy airmen. A yearning for far horizons was programmed into the Voorhees genes. Richard Voorhees and his older sibs, Farnham and Evelyn, were born in Assawamset, one of the longest-settled American worlds, where their parents were based with the 14th Fleet. Far and Evie carried on the family tradition, line officers both, she commanding a diplomatic courier, he the exec on one of the asteroid-sized colonization transports. Both had served with distinction during the brief metapsychic rebellion of the 80s, a credit to the family name, to the service, and to humanity at large. Then there was Richard. He also went to the stars, but not in government service. The structured military life was repellent to him, and he was excessively xenophobic as well. Members of the five exotic races were common visitors at Assawamset Sector Base, and Richard had hated and feared them from the time he was a toddler. Later, in school, he found a rationalization for the dread as he read about the half-century preceding the intervention on old Earth, when more and more frequent probings by the eager anthropologists of the milieu had disturbed and sometimes terrified humanity. The Krandaku had been guilty of particularly tactless experimentation, and crews from certain Symbiari worlds had even descended to mischief-making among the natives when overcome by ennui during long surveillance tours. The Galactic Concilium had dealt sternly with such transgressions, which were fortunately few. Nevertheless, a remnant of the old alien invasion psychosis persisted in human folklore even after the intervention had opened the way to the stars. Mild manifestations of xenophobia were rather common among human colonists, but not many people carried their prejudice as far as Richard Voorhees. Fanned by feelings of personal inadequacy, the irrational fears of the child matured into full-blown hatred in the grown man. Richard rejected milieu service and turned instead to a career as a commercial spacer. There he could pick and choose his shipmates and the ports he visited. Farnham and Evelyn tried to be understanding of their brother's problem, but Richard knew all too well that the fleet officers secretly looked down upon him.
"Our brother the traitor," they would say and laugh. "Well, it's not quite as bad as being a pirate."
Richard had to pretend to be a good sport about the jibing for more than 20 years, while he worked his way up from space hand to mate, to hired skipper, to owner-operator. The day came at last when he could stand at the dock at Bedford Starport and admire the quarter-clomb sleekness of CSS Wolverton Mountain, rejoicing that she was his own. The ship had been a VIP speedster equipped with the most powerful superluminal translator, as well as oversized inertialess drivers for slower-than-light travel. Voorhees had the passenger accommodations ripped out and converted her to a full auto-express cargo, because that was where the real money was. He let it be known that there was no journey too long or too dangerous for him to dare. No risk he was not prepared to undertake in the delivery of a rare or desperately needed load anywhere in the galaxy. And the clients came. In the years that followed, Richard Voorhees made the appalling hub run 8 times before the precarious colonies there were abandoned. He burned out 4 sets of Upsilon energy field crystals and nearly fused his own nervous system on a record-breaking run to Hercules Cluster. He carried drugs and life-saving equipment and parts to fix vital machinery. He expedited samples of ores and cultures and suspect organisms from outlying human colonies to the vast laboratories of the Old World. He was able to prevent the eugenic catastrophe on Bafut by rushing in replacement sperm. He had given mild gratification to a dying tycoon by speeding 1 precious bottle of Jack Daniels from Earth to the faraway Cumberland system. He had toted just about everything but the serum to Nome and the message to Garcia. Richard Voorhees became rich and a little famous, underwent rejuvenation, acquired a taste for antique aeroplanes, rare Earth vintages, gourmet goodies, and dancing women, grew a big black mustache, and told his distinguished older brother and sister to go screw themselves. And then, on a certain day in 2110, Richard sowed the seed of his own ruin. He was alone, as usual, on the bridge of Wolverton Mountain, deep in the gray negation of subspace, going balls up for the isolated Orisa system, 1870 light years south of the galactic plane. His cargo was a large and intricate temple of Juggernaut, including sacred images and rolling stock intended to replace a religious complex that had been accidentally destroyed on the Hindu-settled planet. Old-world artisans, using tools and ancient patterns now unavailable to their colonial kin, had crafted a perfect replica, but they had taken much too long doing it. Voorhees' contract specified that he had to get the temple and its statuary to Orisa within 17 days, before the local celebration of Rath Yatra, when the god's effigy was scheduled to be transported in solemn procession from the temple to a summer dwelling. If the ship arrived late, and the faithful had to commemorate their holy days without the sacred edifice and images, the shipping fee would be halved, and it was a very large fee. Voorhees had been confident of meeting the deadline. He programmed the tightest hyperspatial catenary, made sure he had extra dope for the pain of breaking through the superficies on short leash, and settled down to play chess with the guidance computer and trade gossip with the ship's other systems. Wolverton Mountain was completely automated except for her skipper. But Richard had sufficient vestigial social tendencies to program all of the robotics with individual identities and voices, together with input from the scandal sheets of his favorite worlds, jokes, and sycophantic chatter. It helped to pass the time. "Communications to bridge," said a winsome contralto, interrupting Richard's attack on the computer's queen.
"Voorhees here. What is it, Lily darling?"
"We've intercepted a contemporaneous subspace distress signal," the system said. "A Poltrian research vessel is dead in the matrix with translator trouble. Navigation is plotting its pseudo-locus."
"Damn grinning little dwarfs, probably poking around in their usual busybody way, and all the while letting the U-crystals deteriorate without proper maintenance."
"Navigation to bridge."
"Yes, Fred."
"That vessel in distress is damn near our catenary, Captain. They're lucky. This slice of the hype doesn't get much traffic."
Richard's fist closed around a chess pawn and squeezed. So now he could go nursemaid the little buggers, and kiss half his commission goodbye like as not. It would probably take several subjective days to make repairs, considering the fumble-fingeredness of the Paltroyans, and the fact that Wolverton Mountain carried only 3 robot excursion engineers. If it was a ship full of humans in distress, there'd be no question of heaving to. But exotics?
"I've acknowledged receipt of the distress signal," Lily said. "The Paltroyan vessel is in a state of life system deterioration. They've been trapped for some time, Skipper."
Oh, hell. He was only 2 days out of Orisa. The Paltroons could certainly hang on for a few days longer. He could catch them on the flip-flop.
"Attention all systems. Carry on original subspace vector. Communications. Cease all external transmissions. Lily, I want you to erase from the log that distress signal and all subsequent inter- and intra-ship communications up to the sound of my mark. Ready? Mark."
Richard Voorhees made his delivery in time and collected the entire fee from the grateful worshippers of Juggernaut. A Lilmic fleet cruiser rendered assistance to the Paltroyans at about the same time that Voorhees docked on Orisa. The Paltroyans had less than 15 hours of oxygen remaining in their life support system when the rescuers arrived. The Paltroyans turned their recording of Voorhees' initial response to the distress signal over to the Sector Magistratum. When Richard returned to Assawamset, he was placed under arrest on suspicion of violating the Galactic Altruism Statutes, Section 24, Ethical Obligations of Deep Space Vessels. After being convicted of the charge, Richard Voorhees was fined a stupendous sum that wiped out most of his assets. Wolverton Mountain was confiscated, and her skipper proscribed from engaging in any aspect of astrogation or interstellar commerce for the rest of his natural lives. "I think I'll visit the old world," Richard told his solicitor after the whole thing was over. "They say you can't beat it as a place to blow your brains out." 4. Felice Landry sat erect in the saddle on the back of her 3-ton Varel, stun gun cradled in her right arm. She bowed her head in acknowledgement of the cheers. There were nearly 50,000 fans in the arena for the big game, a splendid turnout for a small planet such as Akadi. Landry nudged the Varel into a complicated routine of dressage. The hideous beast, resembling a stilt-legged rhino, with a Ceratopsian neck frill and wicked, glowing eyes, minced in and out of the bodies without stepping on a single one. Of all the players on the green and white sawdust grid, Landry was the only one still mounted and conscious. Other Varels in the sideline pens behind the Burladero added their trumpeting to the crowd's applause. With casual skill, Felice had her mount pick up the scarlet ring with its nose horn. Then she sent the animal galloping toward the now undefended white wing goal, even though there was no longer any need for speed. "Landry! Landry!" screamed the spectators. It seemed that the young girl and the beast would crash into the cavernous scoop at the end of the field, but just before they were upon it, Landry gave the Varel a sharp cross rein and an unspoken command. The creature wheeled full about, tossing its monstrous head, which was nearly as long as the girl's body. The ring went sailing through the air and entered the scoop dead center. The goal signal lit up and blared in triumph. "Landry!" She held her gun high and shouted back at the mob. Shockwaves of orgasm surged through her. For a long minute she could not see, nor did she hear the single deep peal from the referee's bell that marked the end of the game. As her senses cleared, she condescended to smile at the leaping, gesticulating throng. "Celebrate my victory, people, children, lovers. Call my name, but do not press." "Landry! Landry! Landry!" A ref came trotting up with the championship banner hanging at the end of a long lance. She holstered the stun gun, took the flag, and raised it up. She and the Varel made a slow circuit of the arena, both of them nodding to the deafening plaudits of Greenhammer and White Wing fans alike. There had never been such a season. Never such a championship game. Never before the coming of Felice Landry. The sports-mad people of Canadian Acadie took their ring hockey very seriously. At first, they had resented Landry for daring to play the dangerous game. Then they had devoured her. Short, slightly built, but preternaturally strong of mind and body, with an uncanny ability to control the evil-tempered Verrill Mounts, Felice had vanquished male players of talent and experience to become a sports idol in her first professional season. She played both offense and defense. Her lightning-fast stun coups became a legend. She herself had never fallen. In this, the last match of the championship series, she had scored 8 goals, a new record. With all of her teammates downed in the final period, she had single-handedly fought off White Wings' last-ditch assault on the Greenhammer goal. 4 stubborn giants of the White Wing team had bitten the dust before she triumphed and went on to score that last go-to-hell goal. Applaud. Adore. Tell me I am your queen mistress victim. Only stay back. She guided the Verrill toward the player's exit, fragile on the back of the monstrous animal. She wore an iridescent green kilt and green head plumes on the back-tilted helmet. The once buoyant frizz of her platinum hair now straggled in limp ropes against the shiny black leather of her skimpy hoplite-style kuyabui armor.
Landry! Landry!
I have poured myself and discharged myself for you. Slaves, eaters, violators, now let me go. Small medical carts were scuttling through the passageway toward the arena to bring in the stunned. Felice had to keep firm control of the nervous Verrill as she moved toward the Greenhammer ramp. Suddenly there were people all around her. Assistants, trainers, Verrill grooms, second-string bench warmers, gophers, and hangers-on. They raised a ragged cheer of greeting and congratulation, tinged with over-familiarity. The heroine among her own. She gave a tight, regal smile. Someone took the bridle of the Verrill and soothed it with a bucket of feed.
Felice! Felice, baby!
Coach McGowan, hot from the observation booth and still trailing game plan tapes, like a person caught in an old-time ticker tape parade, came pounding down from the upper level of the arena.
You were unbelievable, lovey! Glorious, pyrotechnic, kaleidoscopic!
Here you go, Coach, she said, leaning down from the saddle and passing him the banner. Our first pennant, but not our last. The jostling partisans began to shout.
You tell the world, Felice. Say again, sweetie baby.
The Verrill gave a warning growl. Landry extended a graceful, black-gauntleted arm toward the coach. McGowan yelled for somebody to bring a dismounting platform. Groom steadied the animal while the girl allowed the coach to hand her down.